From the Center for the Study of God and Culture and the studios of Faith Talk 1500, it's the Paul Edwards Program. Information, commentary, and podcast are always online at godandculture.com. Now, here's your host, Paul Edwards.
Almost from the very beginning of this program 6 years ago, when we first went on the air here on Faith Talk 1500, I have argued that the church, particularly the evangelical church of conservative varieties, often try too hard to be relevant at the expense of doing what it is they ought to be doing, which is just plainly preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ and letting the chips fall where they may. But, you know, many churches, even in our listening area, have decided that that doing creative things in their worship services that really look more like MTV, they look more like a music award show in their worship, that those kind of things would help to retain and attract a younger generation of people than would happen if they just simply did what churches have historically always done, which is focus on the confessions, on the traditional worship, and the preaching of the Word of God. I may be vindicated to a certain extent here in a piece that I first came across about a month ago by Megan O'Giblin in an online magazine called Guernica, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, and our guest Megan will correct me in a moment if I'm wrong. Megan has a piece here in July, Sniffing Glue, A Childhood in Christian Pop, and among other things that she says, I was homeschooled up until 10th grade, and my social life revolved around church. I grew up submersed in evangelical youth culture, reading Brio magazine, doing devotions in my Youth Walk Bible, eagerly awaiting the next installment of the Left Behind series, and developing a taste in music that ran the gamut from Christian rap to Christian pop to Christian rock. Fast forward, and she says, over the past 10 years, I visited churches that have Starbucks kiosks in the foyer and youth wings decked out with air hockey tables. I've witnessed a preacher stop his sermon to play a 5-minute clip from Billy Madison. I've walked into a sanctuary that was blasting the Black Eyed Peas' Let's Get It Started to get the congregation pumped for the morning's message, which was on joy. I have heard a pastor say from a pulpit, hey, I'm not here to preach at anyone. And yet, in spite of these efforts, churches are retaining only 4% of the young people raised in their congregations. Megan concludes by saying, despite all the affected teenage rebellion, I continue to call myself a Christian into my early 20s. When I finally stopped, it wasn't because being a believer made me uncool or outdated or freakish. It was because being a Christian no longer meant anything. It was a label to slap on my Facebook page next to my music preferences. The gospel became just another product someone was trying to sell me, and a paltry one at that, because the church isn't Viacom. It doesn't have a department of brand strategy and planning. Staying relevant in late consumer capitalism requires highly sophisticated resources and the willingness to tailor your values to whatever your audience wants. In trying to compete in this market, the church has forfeited the one advantage it had in the game to attract disillusioned youth: authenticity. Megan O'Giblin is my guest, and Megan, I'm honored that you'd take some time to talk with us. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I guess the big question that I have, and many in our audience are going to have, is when you say you finally stopped calling yourself a Christian after you reached your early 20s, does this also mean that you no longer consider yourself a believer in the fundamentals of the Christian faith?
Yeah, I don't consider myself a believer anymore, which for the sake of the article, I had to kind of reduce it to a more simplistic narrative, I guess, than what actually happened. But definitely the CCM movement and sort of the Seeker Friendly movement was the first step in that, where I started to sense that there was something just kind of inauthentic about the church. And I was not a part of the church for a very long time. Throughout most of my 20s, I considered myself an atheist and didn't want anything to do with the church. And now I'm kind of at a point in my life where I think I'm more open to spirituality. So I guess I'm kind of processing through a lot of things. I'm a little more open to it now and sort of processing through the faith I was raised in and sort of doing that through writing a lot, through writing articles like this. So.
Well, you know, most people in this audience probably have not read your piece, so let's give them, you know, the Reader's Digest version, if we can. Go back to your childhood. What was your first exposure to contemporary Christian music, and what was your life like in your home? I'm assuming you were raised in a typical traditional evangelical Christian home.
I was, yeah, and I was homeschooled. All of my siblings and I were homeschooled up until high school. So I guess we had kind of a sheltered life. I mean, most of my friends were from church, so we were part of this evangelical subculture. We all listened to the same music, which was all Christian music. I really didn't have much knowledge of secular culture or secular music at all. So that was basically my youth. My first exposure to CCM, actually the first album I ever bought was by an artist named Carmen, which I'm not sure if he's still around now, but he was sort of a traditionally gospel artist. I think he toured with the Gaithers and did a lot of like contemporary adult / worship music in the 70s and 80s. And in the 90s, early 90s, he came out with an album called The Standard, which this is the first CD I bought, which was like very clearly targeted at a younger audience. So he had several hip-hop songs on it, and the hit song was called Who's in the House, in which he refers to Christ as JC. And I don't know, looking back on it now, it just seems like kind of sad, because there's this, you know, he's at this point in his career, I think he's probably in his mid-40s or something, you know, so this very distinguished-looking middle-aged man who's in the music video wearing, like, a hoodie sweatshirt and high-top sneakers and doing really bad rap about Jesus. So I think this is kind of typical of sort of that early, like, contemporary Christian music of that era in the early 90s, where there were sort of just these very clumsy efforts to meet kids where they're at and speak their language and reach them with the gospel. But they got more sophisticated, I think, as time went on. And I talk about in the article, you know, eventually I moved on from Carmen to, like, these hipper bands like DC Talk, Audio Adrenaline, Jars of Clay. And these were artists and bands. They're bands that were mostly fronted by young people. And, you know, they had the whole look. They had, like, the tattoos and piercings, and they sounded very similar to what was being played on MTV and on secular radio at the time. So, and a lot of these bands were, I mean, they're pretty unapologetically Christian during this era still. Like, if you go back and listen to DC Talk's early albums, they talk about God, and they say Jesus in about every song, you know, so the gospel's there. But the underlying message is, you know, being a Christian is cool, and you don't have to sacrifice your social status to follow Christ. So those were the bands I listened to, and that's sort of the message that I bought, I guess, as a young person before I discovered secular music.
And your discovery of secular music, you make it clear, and this is where the title of your piece comes from, Sniffing Glue. You make it clear that you felt like you had somehow been cheated when you finally had an exposure to secular music. Is your disenchantment with Christianity in particular and spirituality, at least earlier, in general, because of you felt like that you were being deceived by groups like Jars of Clay, DC Talk, and others who were trying to pass themselves off maybe as on the line of secular, and yet kind of really, they're just being evangelistic in their lyric, but trying to sound like you know, the typical pop group in the quote unquote real world.
Yeah, I think definitely that was the case. You know, because I went for so long just listening to these Christian groups and thinking that what they were doing was original, and then come to find out, you know, when I see the real thing, first time I watch MTV and watch, you know, videos by Nirvana and sort of all these bands that the Christian artists were trying to emulate. And I realized that this is sort of just a cheap substitute for the real thing. And, yeah, I think I was kind of disillusioned at that point, because it made not only the artists but just the message that they represented seem very phony and inauthentic. And, you know, as a kid, I mean, you're marketed to constantly. by advertising and people who are trying to get money from you. So when you see, you know, the church, or you see Christian bands that are trying to do the same thing and try to sort of sell you this cool message, you know, immediately you get a little suspicious about that. So yeah, I think it was very disillusioning for me.
How does that translate, Megan? We're talking with Megan O'Giblin here about her piece in July on her and if I'm mischaracterizing this, Megan, correct me, but her loss of faith, given where the CCM movement was, as she's just described for us. But how does your disillusionment with contemporary Christian music translate into your disillusionment with Christianity in general?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's actually one of the biggest criticisms that I got of the article, was that, you know, if you lost your faith over the music, it must have been a pretty shallow faith to begin with. Which I don't know, maybe that was true to some extent. I think when you're raised in a Christian family, you spend a lot of time kind of piggybacking on the faith of your parents. And when you become a teenager, you're kind of at this pivotal moment where you've got to decide if you're going to make the faith your own or not. And, you know, when I got to that point, it just seemed very phony to me. And I didn't look at them. I mean, I didn't look at the message as much, because the message, it seemed like it was hardly there anymore. It had gotten so watered down. And this wasn't just CCM. This is sort of the church as a whole. Everything was about becoming more seeker-friendly, becoming more accessible to the newcomer, and sort of just trying to seduce teens into thinking that Christianity was cool. So as soon as I realized that message was false, I don't know, I kind of lost track of what it meant to really live your faith. And, I mean, the reasons that I don't consider myself a Christian today are different than the reasons that I left when I was, you know, in my early 20s. I guess they have more to do with, like, doctrinal or theological issues. But I think that first step was mostly the cultural, what was going on in the culture.
Well, when was the last time you were in an evangelical church? I mean, you talk about a time when, over the past 10 years, you visited churches with Starbucks kiosks in the foyer and Billy Madison on the screen and the Black Eyed Peas blaring out. That obviously was not your experience in church as a child growing up homeschooled, I'm sure. When did you have these experiences with these kind of so-called seeker churches, and what about them turns you off? Because you're the very kind of person that the pastors and leadership of these churches think that they're going to reach with this kind of stuff.
Right. Well, yeah, most of those, I mean, that part of the article I'm talking about, churches I visited as an adult, which I come from a very large Christian family, and I'm still very close with my family. So whenever I go to visit them, I attend church with them. And same with my siblings and the churches that they attend. So it's mostly been through my family and friends that I've still sort of stayed connected to the church. I can only speak for myself, I guess, but to me, I mean, if I want to see a rock show, you know, I can go to a concert and see a real rock show, but, you know, if I'm going to church, it's because I want something a little more substantial, I guess, something with a little more meaning that I can't find in the outside world. And I think a lot of that, although I know there's a lot of churches that are still, you know, preaching very theologically dense sermons, but for the most part, I feel like it's become a lot more like motivational speeches instead of sermons, and sort of this, I don't know, just very being very cautious that and being very very conscious of how the church is coming off as a product to the unchurched or to young people. And I don't know, that kind of self-consciousness is not very appealing. I would rather visit a church that is, you know, standing by its beliefs and offering something a little more substantial, I guess.
Megan O'Giblin, my guest. She's currently pursuing a master in fine arts at University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is an author of short fiction, collections of essays, and in July had a piece in, am I pronouncing it right, Megan, Guernica?
Guernica, yeah.
Guernica, a magazine of art and politics. It's an online magazine, and we'll get that linked at our website along with her piece, Sniffing Glue. Going to take a quick break, and Megan will continue. And when we do, I want you to talk to us about your understanding of authenticity. What would an authentic Christian church look like that might be attractive to you? In terms of maybe getting you to maybe not totally recommit, but it would at least be a beginning place for you. What does authentic Christianity look like to you? We'll continue our conversation with Megan O'Giblin here on the Paul Edwards Program.
Do you tweet? We do. Get the latest scoop by following us on twitter.com/faithtalk1500.
Megan O'Giblin is currently a Master in Fine Arts candidate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, working on short fiction and a collection of essays, and the author of this very interesting piece back in July that was published in Guernica magazine online, Sniffing Glue, A Childhood in Christian Pop. And one of the things, Megan, that you point out in your piece is just about the time that MTV was catching on to the rise and growing interest in spirituality among teenagers, the church seemed to be moving away from that as an appeal to young people. And you point out that the Music Trendsetters study coined the word pessimisticism. What is pessimisticism, and what of this trend that sees the secular world pursuing spirituality while the church seems to be moving away from it?
Yeah, so pessimisticism, this is a term that was coined by a research team at MTV's brand strategy and planning department. So MTV's got this whole large department that's basically dedicated to going out and researching teens and finding what they like so that they can create programming that's relevant to them. So in around the mid-90s, they came out with this term pessimisticism, which they said described the attitude of teens today. So it's a combination of pessimism, so sort of disillusionment with commercial music, and disillusionment with the shallowness of it and the fact that there wasn't a lot of content, not a lot of meaning to it. And then also mysticism, so this sort of yearning for higher expression in music or interest in spirituality. And you can see this, I mean, I didn't find out any of this until I stopped and did research. But I remember, you know, when I was a teenager, like a lot of bands on MTV and on secular radio, you know, there was references to God and to spirituality constantly. In fact, like I used to try to pass some of my secular albums off as Christian to my parents because it was so easy to do. There were so many, you know, references to God. And it turns out it wasn't coincidental. It's because they actually found that this is what kids wanted. So, you know, in a way, I guess CCM kind of dropped the ball there because they had exactly what teens were looking for, but they didn't realize it and sort of kept watering their message down to mimic what was on MTV. So it's a really interesting thing that was happening at that time.
And you would be the first to admit, I think, Megan, having read your piece, you would be the one of the first to admit, because there are people driving the logs freeway in Detroit right now that are probably yelling at their radio and saying, yeah, but, you know, secular music artists are inauthentic, too. I mean, it is marketing. I mean, and you point out in your piece that that MTV has and Viacom has a whole marketing department to make their music appealing, to find out what exactly the kids are wanting to consume. So why the attraction for you to a marketed version of secular music, and a disconnect when Christian music is marketed in the same way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I don't think it was so much that I was finding something meaningful in secular culture. I mean, I think at that point, you know, I've become disillusioned sort of with everything. I mean, I think teens in the 90s were definitely disillusioned with the commercial music industry, too. And I think the problem was that the church wasn't providing any alternative to that, you know. So, like, living in this very sort of shallow media-saturated, advertising-saturated culture, and the church traditionally, I think, has sort of been a refuge from that and a sanctuary. And once that started penetrating the church, it seemed like it wasn't so much a special place anymore. You know, they were trying to do exactly the same thing that the world is doing, only they did it, you know, not as well, because they just don't have the resources that someone like MTV has.
What would an authentic church look like to you? I mean, if you were in an ideal world, able to develop, to manufacture a church that is stripped of all of this stuff that you rightly point out in your article that many seeker churches have become. What are the irreducible minimums for you that would be attractive to you now as a secularist, someone who grew up in a Christian home and homeschooled, but now became disenchanted with the Christian faith because of its lack of authenticity? What elements in a worship experience for you would be necessary to find that authenticity?
I don't know if I can answer that. I mean, on one hand, I mean, I was just writing my experience, and I didn't start off, intending to write this story about the inauthenticity of the church. I was just writing an essay, actually, for an assignment for school. The assignment was to write a piece of music criticism, and so I thought it was just going to be sort of a fun article, and I kind of stumbled on all these ideas and feelings that I hadn't revisited for a long time, and sort of realized that I had stronger feelings about it than I had realized. I realized that the article seems a little more prescriptive towards the end, or a little preachy, and I don't know if I intended it to be that way, but I don't know. I'm glad that I started a conversation at least about this, and I think it's up to those in ministry to sort of figure out what to do about it. I guess personally, I just don't want to speak for my whole generation, but me personally, I really miss the old hymns and sort of the type of more traditional service that I grew up with. And I do feel like, I know I have some friends who are still believers, friends that I grew up with, and it seems like they're starting to sort of gravitate towards those more traditional old guard churches, and even more sort of Orthodox churches.
Why do you think that is? Why would the old style churches be attractive to your generation when, George Barna and all the Christian marketing experts have been telling pastors for years, hey, we've got to get away from pulpits, we got to get away from hymns, we got to look more like an MTV set. And yet you're telling me that at least for yourself, and I realize you're not speaking for your entire generation, but you're not the only person from your generation that I've heard this from. And my argument has been, and I'm 50, I just turned 50, just so you get some context on where I am. And I've been an evangelical pastor for 25 years of the conservative variety. And my church, the churches I pastored, have never followed the trends that Barna and others said we should follow in order to attract a crowd. We've always been traditional, somewhat liturgical, in an evangelical sense. And I've been saying all along, Megan, that if we will stay where we are and not follow the trends, that eventually this generation is going to come back to us, because they're going to find the seeker sensitive churches very shallow and not able to really meet their needs, and they're eventually going to come back. Is your experience am I vindicated with that position that eventually some folks, and again, I'm not asking you to speak for your entire generation, but for yourself, you would find yourself coming back to tradition rather than these modern worship services?
Yeah, definitely. And especially now that I'm older, I'm almost 30 now. So, I mean, I don't know how it is for younger teens today. Maybe it is true that they're turned off by tradition, but I know that, now that I'm at a place in my life where I'm more mature, and I kind of miss that tradition. I feel like that's something that you can't really find in the secular world, And one of the things I discovered while doing this piece is just how much of the culture is marketed to young people. Everything is about, creating a package for or a product for young people because they have so much disposable income. And I think along with that, there's sort of not a lot of respect for tradition and for, I think Americans in general have less respect for tradition than other cultures, Asian cultures or Latin American cultures. And I think there's a real hunger for that.
What is it, Megan, about tradition itself, the old hymns, in a worship context that draws you, that appeals to you?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. It may be something as simple as if that's what I grew up with. But, I mean, I do feel, and this might just be my bias, but I feel like there's just a lot more substance to that sort of traditional worship music. I mean, the hymns have very complex ideas in them. If you go back and read the lyrics to these old hymns by, you know, that are in a traditional hymnal, if you can even find a hymnal in a church today, you know, I just find those a lot more, at least thought-provoking, I guess, and satisfying than these sort of repetitive mantra praise courses that are being played today. And the church just has a great, rich cultural legacy, too, you know. And I don't think that should throw that by the wayside. I heard somebody use the example of, Jacob selling his birthright for a bowl of lentils, right? Sort of this idea that the church has this great heritage that they're just willing to give up to try to woo teens. And I don't know. I don't think it's working very well.
You use the word substance. Tradition for me includes that, but it also includes stability. There's something about something that's been around a long, long time that you can make yourself a part of, and you become a part of history. I mean, when you recite the Apostles' Creed, as we do not every Sunday in our church, but frequently in our church, we're reciting something that that has been being quoted in a worship context among believers for 1800 years, maybe even longer than that. So not only do you get the substance, but you get the stability. Is there a sense in which your worship experience in the so-called seeker-sensitive churches lacks the stability that you're looking for?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, that goes back to the idea of authenticity, too. I mean, if you're just willing to change for whatever trend is popular at the time, you know, it doesn't say very much for, you know, the values that you're preaching from your pulpit, I guess, right? And the advantage that Christians have is that these are, you know, timeless values. Like, the Bible's a very, very old book, and you know, that's something that you don't find out in the world where, you know, fashion is just keeps changing more quickly, you know, every year, it seems like. And I don't know if that answers your question.
One of the things that I about fell off my chair is hearing someone of your generation mention Fanny Crosby in a positive way. Fanny Crosby is my favorite hymn writer, and I learned something from your piece, Megan, and I appreciate you doing the research to bring this out. I never knew that she wrote Rosalie the Prairie Flower and earned as much money off of it as she did.
Right, yeah, I didn't realize that either, which is funny. Our parents, when I was homeschooled, we had to read a biography on her. But I guess either that wasn't included or I had forgotten about it. But I thought that was a really interesting fact, too. And she was something. She was someone who was very adamant about not using the styles of the world to in any form of worship, you know, because she used to write these popular songs, and she was very conscious about once she started writing hymns, she didn't want them to sound like what was being played in the saloons or whatever, you know, which is sort of exactly the opposite of what CCM artists are trying to do today.
Yeah, you know, you point out she wrote Blessed Assurance and He Hideth My Soul and so many other the great hymns that are in our hymn book. But then you say she believed in an ideal that today seems ridiculous in all but the most fundamentalist circles, that Christian culture should remain set apart from the trends and caprices of the world. Contemporary Christian worship today is really all about trying to get as close to the world as possible. And what you're suggesting, Megan, is that really is a turnoff to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's just at some point it's like the church doesn't have anything to offer anymore. Like, I think there's a Spurgeon quote, I believe, where he says, you know, the reason that the church has so little influence over the world is because the world has so much influence over the church. And I think that's kind of become true. Like, there's nothing... it seems like there's very little that's special about Christianity as far as what you find in a contemporary worship service. It's a lot of just sort of a lighter version of stuff you'd find on the radio or, you know, on TV.
Does your disillusionment, and we're going to end where we began, sort of, but Megan, does your disillusionment with the church translate into a disillusionment with Jesus Christ? Do you still have a relationship, a personal relationship with Jesus Christ?
I don't, and that's one of those things. I guess I'm sort of becoming more open to. I don't know, a lot of these things, I didn't realize I had such strong feelings about this until I started writing, you know, so I'm sort of rethinking a lot of things I believe right now, and I guess I'm kind of spiritually confused in a lot of ways, but I understand that the culture is not the same as the message, and that, you know, believers are not necessarily, you know, representative of Christ or of Christianity. I don't know, I guess that's something... That's sort of a separate issue, I guess, I have to think over on my own.
You know, I would love to be able to sit down with you one-on-one at a Starbucks someplace and just and have a candid conversation about spirituality in just a personal, friendly kind of way, Megan, because I sense your sincerity, and my heart goes out to you. It's tragic. From my perspective, as an evangelical pastor and as an evangelical Christian, it's tragic to me to hear your story, to hear that it's one thing to lose your faith in organized religion and to lose your faith in the church, but for organized religion to cause you to lose your faith in Jesus Christ, that breaks my heart. And I'm going to say something that's very pat. It's going to sound very pat, but I want you to know I mean it sincerely, that you will be at the top of my prayer list as I think about people who I really want to not just be on a search and a journey, but to, you know, Bono sings that great song, one of my favorite U2 songs, "I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For." He sings that not because he is incomplete. He has found, I think, is what he's saying, I have found Jesus, but it hasn't come to a fulfillment yet. It's almost like what the Apostle Paul, I think, says in the book of Romans, that we are waiting for the redemption of the body, that we've had part of our redemption, but it's not complete yet. And you're on a journey, and I'm on a journey. You still haven't found what you're looking for. And my prayer for you is that you will get beyond the mess that the church has made of the gospel in so many ways, and that you will come to see Jesus as your hope. That you will not blame Jesus for what the world has done to, or not the world, but the church rather, what the church has done to his gospel. And I want you to know that I sincerely mean that. I don't often tell guests that I'm going to be praying for them, and because it sounds so pat, but my heart goes out to you, and I almost feel like I owe you an apology for what the church has done to your faith.
Oh no, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Megan O'Giblin is a Master of Fine Arts candidate at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and we'll get her piece, Sniffing Glue, linked at our website at godandculture.com.